All right. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. First of all, I want to go through what is on the schedule. I'm going to drop right down to the work sessions and let everyone know that everything that's scheduled to work sessions are not going to be able to move today. We do not have paperwork for Senate Bill 1551, 1531, and 1556. Those will be carried over till tomorrow. I'll say that one more time. Because we do not have the paperwork on those three bills, 1551, 1531, and 1556, they will be carried over till tomorrow's agenda, which is Thursday, the 13th. Regarding Senate Bill 1508, at the request of Senator Lori Moniz-Anderson, that bill is not going to be moving forward this session.
Which one?
1508. She has requested that this be placed into some type of a task force or work group. What I've told her is that the Judiciary Committee would be more than willing to have an informal group, not having something that's done by bill or by law, to have that picked up during our Judiciary interim work. And I believe that that may include the House, but I'm not positive at this point. So for those who are here on the work sessions, again, 1508 is going into a work session or work group, I should say, during the interim. 1551, 1531, and 1556 are carried over till tomorrow. All right. With that, what we have for the rest of the day we have 1540, Senate Bill 1546, and 1550. Regarding 1550, the attorney who is representing the victim that was kind of like the catalyst for this to be brought up during the 13th session will be joining us by phone at around 9 o'clock or sometime after 9 o'clock, I should say. We will be contacting his office, and he will be providing us with information that they would prefer that bill in the sense of the substance of that bill to not go forward this session. Because they would like to see a broader discussion about maybe some other alternatives and fixes that they have looked at since they've reviewed our draft of the 1550. But because there are other possibilities for use of that relating clause, we will be going through a public hearing on that to leave that open, and then potentially we'll bring it back tomorrow. So that's going to leave us for what we're going to take up. First will be Senate Bill 1540, so I will open the public hearing on 1540. Donna?
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 1540 on February 4th. This is Senator Winter's bill that prohibits bad faith claims of patent infringement. Today you have before you the -4 amendments and the -6 amendments. The -4 amendments expand recipients to include those doing business in the state, so a person who's doing business in the state may bring one of these claims. It also changes mandatory action by the Attorney General to permissive action and clarifies that the court also plays a gatekeeping role in this. It allows recipients to have a private right of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The -6 amendments have all of those components within it, but it adds an additional subsection dealing with good faith claims, and that the measure does not apply to claims that are brought in good faith and under federal patent law.
All right, thank you. So I have three people that are scheduled to testify, Aaron, Tim, and Steve. On the three of you, please come up. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 1540? And Steve, I know you're here on behalf of Senator Winters. I'm going to go ahead and let you go ahead and start off as the presenter, and then we'll bring in DOJ and talk about their perspectives on the two amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Elzinga. I work for the Senate Republican Office, and I'm here on behalf of Senator Winters, who is unable to be here this morning. Senator Winters strongly supports Senate Bill 1540 as modified by the -4 amendments. The -4 amendments give the Department of Justice extra flexibility in enforcement, add protections for cities that were requested by the City of Portland, and they also make several technical changes that were brought up to us by Legislative Council. The -6s as mentioned, are similar to the Dash 4s. They add a tweak to the safe harbor language that was requested by a patent holder group. We understand that DOJ has some concerns with that change, so Senator Winters would request that you go ahead and move the bill with just the Dash 4s at this time to give DOJ more time to look at the Dash 6s and continue to talk with stakeholders that are interested in that. Legislative Council believes that the Dash 6s do not make any substantive changes, so Senator Winters is not concerned that there's any problem with moving forward without those at this point in time, and I'm happy to answer any questions on any of the amendments.
All right, so I think what we're going to do, go ahead and hear from DOJ. I guess, Tim, you'll probably be taking the point. What we'd like to know is regarding the two amendments, realize that we do have till tomorrow to actually move the bill. If there's some reason that you would want the Dash 6s to be considered, we can wait until tomorrow for moving the bill as compared to, I believe we have all the paperwork necessary for the Dash 4s, so the bill could move today with the Dash 4s, or we can wait till tomorrow and then decide whether we go with the 4s or the 6s. So with that,
I can speak.
Y'all can kind of lay down the positions.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 1540 as modified by the Dash 4s. And it is the preference of the Attorney General and Department of Justice that we move forward with the Dash 4s at this time. Just very briefly, by way of overview, in terms of what 1540 is about, even before we were approached by Senator Winters, the Office of the Attorney General tracks sort of national-level litigation trends and issues that are popping up around the country, and the so-called patent troll issue, I think more fairly referred to not as patent trolls, but patent aggregating entities, had already been on our attention. These are organizations that basically buy up as many patents as they can, usually technical patents, internet patents, things like that. And then as soon as they've acquired those patents, start locating companies that are using or even arguably using whatever the underlying nature of that patent is and start serving them with demand letters. And these entities, normally I think when you think of patent infringement, it's something you made or it's something that you're using and you find out that a competitor is using it too, not giving you enough credit, chipping away at your business. That's not how these organizations have been working. They blast out demand letters, which are often very vague and can lead to sort of patent litigation is very expensive. So if you get one of these demand letters with fancy-looking letterhead on it and you're not a sophisticated organization, or even if you are, I believe the number one most heavily pinged by patent aggregate entities target is Apple. So you see it, big players and small players, the cost of settlement can be hundreds of thousands, even into millions of dollars when considering legal fees. So the pressure on the recipients of these letters to settle can be really very overwhelming. And we've seen awareness of this issue popping up in multiple states, including Oregon, so we were heartened when Senator Winters took the initiative to come forward to us and ask to craft a solution. So to get into the technical bits and pieces of what this bill does, I will turn this over to Tim Nord, the Assistant Attorney in charge of our Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Division.
Thank you, Aaron. Chair Prusansky, Mr. Knott has kind of set the national scene, and we'll talk a little. I'd like to talk a little bit about the bill itself and how it's structured. And my name is Tim Nord. I'm the Assistant Attorney in Charge of Financial Fraud Consumer Protection. And what this bill does, I see it as two things. The first thing is that it's focused upon the actual demand and the communication of the demand itself. It's not dealing with the underlying rights that may exist under the patent, and it has no impact on that. It's about the demand itself and how these matters are initiated. And what the bill does is it creates a potential violation under the UTPA and creates a standard by which entities in Oregon that serve such demands must meet. And if you take a quick look at the bill, it's pretty obvious that to be in a good faith, it does not require a whole lot. Basic information of what patent is involved, who the person is who's asserting it, how you get a hold of them, have they ever successfully litigated and succeeded in enforcing the patent before. And the main goal of requiring it is not necessarily to squelch demands and so forth, but it's to bring efficiency to the process. If you're a business owner in Oregon and you receive one of these blanket demands with very little information and so forth, you're now in this quandary of, you know, am I in violation? Do I hire an attorney? Do I settle? And you have to weigh those costs. And oftentimes the way these entities work is to squeeze that cost out and make business owners make that decision without a whole lot of information. In addition, there, along with the good faith factors, there are a list of the bad faith factors that are in Section 5. But most of those can be avoided simply by, even if the initial demand was insufficient, by supplying information when requested, and there's a whole laundry list there of factors that can relieve someone of being found in bad faith. So the second thing that it really does is it provides our office and the Attorney General the ability to not only investigate and potentially look into whether abusive practices are occurring, but it sets forth factors for the court to consider and gives some guidance that I think is very clear, and rather than having some more ambiguous term that the court then has to interpret. There have been some other states. We've mentioned earlier in the work session, Vermont has passed legislation that has somewhat similar factors. I'll point out that in the Vermont statute, the statutory penalty is as much as $50,000 or treble the damages. So our statute is not that severe. So in general, I think this statute really serves to provide some efficiency to the process and does not determine patent rights and should allow legitimate businesses to operate without any issues.
All right, thank you. Questions? I do have one question. I guess this is really for the Department of Justice. Based on the testimony we heard previously, having an Oregon business that was hit with one of these letters, what, if any, steps did the department take in contacting either the Texas Department of Justice or the bar? Was there any type of follow-up to try to alert that this was coming out of a Texas law firm and trying to hold them accountable through that process?
That particular case, because the way the UTPA is currently set up, being a business-to-business type of complaint is how we saw it. We really didn't have any authority to look into it and so forth, and so we didn't take any action. However, the Attorney General has joined other Attorney Generals in encouraging the Federal Trade Commission to look into the role of specifically, I don't know if it's that exact same firm, but looking into the role of attorneys playing in these types of large blast demands and so forth. And that has been joined and encouraged for the federal legislators to look into and that process. If it were to occur in Oregon, we would, of course, determine if there was a problem. And that highlights one of the issues that comes about by these. Many times the demands do not originate within the state, and in fact they're just received in a state. And that's another reason for a statute like this. Really gives a clear indication that we should have enforcement authority. If we get into a jurisdiction fight and so forth, it shows the interest of our state in this type of conduct.
Okay. It just seems to me that it would be nice for us to at least give word back to the sending state, to their Attorney General, and also, I mean, if appropriate, a bar complaint, because it seems like we should be policing ourselves as attorneys.
I may add something there. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, it's a lot of the coverage on this issue suggests that there's a tremendous concentration of these companies in East Texas for reasons that I think are legal and have to do with the viability of bringing these sorts of suits there. So there, because of the concentration, I think the bar there, the Department of Justice there, and the bench there is very aware of how this works, but that's ultimately where most of these suits are coming to roost when they do go to trial or reach settlement is in East Texas. So sadly, I think there probably is fairly high-level awareness in East Texas of these practices already.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Following up on that, if this law were in place as a law, would you then be contacting those companies in East Texas?
Yes, I mean, once it was received in Oregon, this would empower us if we got a complaint like that. And it looked, obviously that's part of the process is taking a look at the facts around the type of demand and so forth. But if it was one of these blanket demands that was just fired off with no due diligence by the entity that had issued the demand, that would be something that we would have our full investigative authority, which would include issuing CIDs and determining what the facts underline it, and if necessary, bringing an injunction and so forth. In Oregon, we would not have to go to Texas to do that.
Okay, follow up. Yes. And a follow up with this question: there are within the bar of all of our states ethics criteria, and it is an individual responsibility of our attorneys to inform people if there is an ethic, if they perceive an ethics violation. Does that go state to state? I'm getting at the question that he's asking. If that is the case, and we believe that it was an ethics violation for a firm taking this on and doing this, wouldn't we as attorneys in the Department of Justice have an obligation to inform their ethics department in Texas about the issue?
The first issue I see with that is with just having a demand in front of us, without having the power to investigate one way or the other, it's almost impossible to determine what occurred prior to issuing that letter. So it really hamstrings us to not really have any kind of ability to look beyond that.
All right, so next question. This bill's going to pass. I expect it will become law. Once it becomes law, I'd like to see that looked at, because as an attorney in Texas, I would like to know whether or not I should be reporting something to that state, because to me it's one of these situations that in the profession, if we don't take steps to monitor ourselves, it does not look good. And I think that we should in fact be alerting our sister states when we have that type of conduct going on. So my question would be, would this be something that the department could look at in a little greater detail once and if this actually becomes law?
Well, I'll just speak objectively from experience. We have, the department has in Oregon and so forth, gone after attorneys and currently are, particularly in the debt collection area and so forth. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that isn't just ethically, that can potentially be as part of the claim itself. So we do actively look at what role the attorneys are playing in, with whatever conduct is occurring.
Right, including those who are out of state.
Correct.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz.
Just follow up. Just trying to piece all this together. Okay, we pass this. There's activities from a law firm in Texas. It throws a red flag. We take action here. Wouldn't we, as a matter of course, inform the Attorney General in the state of Texas of what we are doing relative to theirs? I mean, I know we can't police their activities, but we can inform them that activities in their state have thrown up red flags in Oregon. Is that the sort of conversation that would happen or not?
Well, as far as I'm aware, and I really don't have knowledge of that, Texas may have no similar law like this. So then it just becomes a question of whether it's an ethics violation or not. And, I'm not that familiar with Texas standards and so forth. And so then we get into a whole another area.
Huh? Or lack thereof.
I guess, Mr. Chair, it's from our perspective, there is an ethics violation. We think we don't have jurisdiction there, but I would think
we don't know that yet because they haven't done the investigation. Right. Once they've done the investigation, if it was an Oregon situation, then they would, be able to opine on it.
I mean, my assumption would be that let's say there's a Oregon firm doing bad things in another state that we're unaware of. I think we would want to be made aware of that by the other state. So I'm just wondering if there's an avenue for this information exchange.
Right, reciprocity. Yeah. It's in the letter.
Yeah. No, I know. I agree.
It clearly, if there's an ethics violation from our perspective, it may not apply in Texas, but I would think that they might want to be aware of it. So I'm just, share on where you're going is how do we get the communication more complete.
Well, at this point, let's see if this makes it all the way through the process, and then we'll have this discussion.
Yep. Any other questions or comments? Senator Close.
Just briefly, maybe Bill could tell us the violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. What penalty is that carrying?
So, Senator Krasanski, Vice Chair Close, the violation of the UTA under this section is a $200 fine if they are in violation or damages. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony again on Senate Bill 1540? Not seeing, we're going to close the public hearing. I understand we do have the paperwork that's necessary for the Dash 4s. Open up a work session on 1540. Senator Close.
Okay, I'll remove the Dash 4s.
Yes.
Sure. I move the Dash 4 amendment into Senate Bill 1540.
Senator Close moves the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 1540. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1540 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close now moves Senate Bill 1540 as amended by the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection? So ordered. Senator Winters will be the carrier of 1540 on the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1540, and that will bring us to Senate Bill 1546. I'll open up a public hearing on 1546.
Chair Persansky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1546 comes to you from Senator Shields for the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. It changes the penalty when an employee, usually a grocery store clerk, unknowingly or unintentionally sells alcohol to a minor while operating a self-checkout device or any other checkout device, and it changes it from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class A violation. You have the proposed Dash 1 amendments before you, which remove the self-checkout device language.
All right. Thank you very much. We have three people that are written in to give testimony today, Beth Cook, Patrick Reed, and Mary Botkin. Why don't the three of you? Oh, I'm sorry. That's all on one line. I thought that one might have been someone. So, Sarah, why don't we do the first three, Beth, Sarah, and Patrick.
Thank you, Chair Krasanski, members of the committee. We're here in support of Senate Bill 1546. Currently under Oregon law, as Ms. Newell mentioned, is a Class A misdemeanor, even on an inadvertent, unknowing, unintentional sale. Oh, for the record, my name is Beth Cook, and I'm here on behalf of UOCW Local 555. Currently under Oregon law, it is a Class A misdemeanor, and it's not always charged as a Class A misdemeanor. What we found is that it's sometimes charged as a violation, so there's not a lot of consistency for unknowing unintentional sales. And what those might be, and these are on off-premises locations, which are your grocery stores. So very often, as your OLCC and your local law enforcement stings, this is not someone sitting outside a grocery store trying to sell alcohol or allowing a minor to purchase alcohol. This is narrowly written for employees only. As you all know, our members are dedicated to keeping alcohol out of the hands of minors. We consider ourselves a line of first defense we take that responsibility very seriously. But the impact of a Class A misdemeanor on the careers of our members is that in our industry, traditionally, very often when someone is hit with this, when they're fined and they're caught in a sting, they're fired. The Class A, having a criminal penalty on their record, then when they go to try to find another job, it often means they're locked out of our industry, or that it's an incredibly arduous process, often requiring a public defender going through that process to try to get that waived, to get that removed from their record. Having spoken with so many of these employees over the last year, it is heartbreaking to hear the stories of, they're not, again, these are unintentional. There's no criminal intent where they have lost, gone from making $14, $15 an hour down to making, several dollars less, a little over $9, $10 an hour. They've lost their health care. They've lost their seniority. We've also begun to hear from many legislators who've said they've had constituents within their districts who not only have they lost their jobs, but they've lost their ability to pass background checks when volunteering within their communities. So, I know that I volunteer for my children's schools and I have to pass a background check. So these are the impact. It's not proportional to to the offense. We ask that you consider this bill and support. Clerks would still be required under ORS 471.341 to take a mandatory training class through OLCC, and by doing that, it would take them automatically into a reduced penalty cycle. So we're only asking for the change on the first offense, but by current statute, they would plug into the training classes, so they would automatically then be taken into a reduced penalty cycle. We are asking that this self-checkout language be removed, but the self-checkout employees would still be covered under the statute, so they're just not being called out specifically. I'll go ahead and let Sarah.
All right. Thank you, Chair Przemski and members of the committee. My name is Sarah DeMeritt, and I used to work at the Lake Oswego Safeway for 12 years. I was working as a clerk in the same store, always knowing that an error could cost me my job and possibly my career. On Thursday, June 27th, 2013, it happened. I arrived at work at 3:30 p.m. I worked in the bakery until 6:30. After taking my lunch, I began covering my check stand as usual. The store was very busy, and for most of the evening, I was the only checker, as usual. At approximately 8:20 p.m., the store had become increasingly busy, and I had had a large line despite calling for backup. I had worked at this store for over 12 years and had known many of the customers by name or on site. I have developed a good rapport with all of them and feel comfortable waiting on my many friends and neighbors. As I rang up a customer at approximately 8:20, I glanced up, recognized a neighbor from up the street, checked out his package of diapers and a six-pack of beer. Immediately after this customer left my line, the next person that showed up showed me her badge and identified herself as an OLCC agent. She said I had just failed an alcohol sting by selling alcohol to a minor. I was interviewed. This is where it gets more humiliating. I was interviewed and processed by a Lake Oswego police officer in the check stand because the store was so busy that no one could let me out. I couldn't have the privacy of going into the office. The officer read my rights and cited me in the check stand while my customers were still trying to get into the line. I was charged with a Class A misdemeanor. I stated in my interview with the police that I thought the customer looked old enough to purchase alcohol based on my thought that he was a familiar neighbor and that I had carted and sold alcohol to him in the past. I have had extensive training in selling alcohol and have passed several OLCC and Safeway company stings in the past. I have denied sales throughout my career. I take my responsibility to keep alcohol out of the hands of minors very seriously. Why would I risk my health benefits, my job, my life, my seniority? In this case, I thought I recognized a familiar customer and sold him the alcohol without asking for his ID. An hour and 20 minutes after my arrest, I was finally asked to shut down my check stand and leave the store. My career at Safeway was over. I fought the charge, and it was an unknowing and unintentional sale. I knew with a criminal conviction I would not work again in my field. I was appointed a public defender. I contacted my Senator Richard Devlin to see how he could help. I have spent months fighting this. No one should go through this. As of now, I am paying hundreds of dollars in court fees. I am charged with a crime. I lost all my health care and my friends and my customer base. Basically, I had to start my life over again. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am very grateful that you are considering this issue.
Thank you. Patrick?
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman. Patrick Reed. I'm a rep for the United Food and Commercial Workers. I worked in grocery stores for 31 years, five of those in Oregon. I'm actually Sarah's rep now and was then. She was such a fine employee that I was able to get her on in another company, but she had to start from zero on her health insurance, which means for the first 6 months, she had none. I'm going to read you a letter from another one of my members. I'm not going to change the wording to, I'm going to read it as if Rochelle had written it, so I don't make any mistakes as I'm going. On August 4, 2011, I was checking at Safeway in Lake Oswego, Oregon, at store 508. I got stung by the OLCC on an alcohol sting. They sent a minor through my line with alcohol. I asked her for her ID. When I typed it in, it said that the birth date was, I thought she was old enough, so I sold her the alcohol. She keyed it into the register with what she read. A police officer at the OLCC representative came into my line and asked me to close it down. He told me I sold alcohol to a minor. I told him he must be wrong because I always ID everyone who looks under 30 years old. He showed me her ID, and I told him the birth date that I still saw was correct to me. What happened is that I misread it because I needed glasses and I didn't know it. I transposed two of the numbers, immediately went to the eye doctor, got a prescription for glasses ordered. The eye doctor wrote a letter stating that I needed glasses and that with the new prescription I would be able to read the numbers well. I was hoping this would help save my job, but it did not. I was let go from Safeway on August 9, 2011, after 5 days. I lost my health insurance, my dental coverage. I had worked for Safeway for almost 15 years. I had a perfect record for proper ID tagging for alcohol and tobacco sales through Safeway and other tests. Safeway's policy of first offense termination is unfair in my case because it was purely accidental. I was the check stand manager and had a good employment record. I had received many awards and was well-liked by my managers, employees, and customers. The Safeway corporate part of the company treated me like a criminal, and they were very rude to me. I tried to fight for my job to no avail. I still do not have health insurance to this date, February 10, 2014. I have recommended for her to sign up on the ACA of Care Oregon. I hope that my story will persuade the Senate to do something and help people who lose their jobs and livelihood on an honest and unintentional mistake. I lost everything when this happened to me, my husband, my credit, my house, and, of course, the medical and dental insurance. I make around half of the income I made at Safeway with no benefits. Please pass this bill so that we can help current retail employees who are honest and who unintentionally make mistakes like I did. We don't deserve to be treated like criminals because we are not criminals. We are hardworking, honest people and deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. Thank you for reading my story, Rochelle Rising. Fred Meyer and Safeway are absolute. If there's an alcohol sale, they terminate on the first offense. I've had three Albertsons employees who have been given the second chance, have gone through the training, and the company has allowed them to continue on. But Safeway and Fred Meyer employees are not afforded that luxury. Even when somebody is proven innocent at the court, the company has already terminated them, and through the grievance process, we're not able to get them back at Fred Meyer and Safeway. And I just hope you would consider passing this bill. There's already a law out there, so it's not like we're creating a new one. We're adjusting the mistake that's in the current one, is my belief. Thank you.
All right. Questions first, Senator Robelin.
Thank you, and thanks for being here. I really appreciate this, and I feel really comfortable about this bill. But my concern is, even if they have a violation, Fred Meyer and Safeway probably aren't going to change their policy, are they?
If,
do you have any expectations they might?
Chair Przanski, Senator Robelin, we don't have that expectation, but it would still leave the opportunity for an employee to apply for another position without having a criminal conviction on their record, because that's unfortunately it makes it so much more difficult for them to find another employer.
Thank you for that clarification.
All right. Question, Patrick. It sounded like at the very end, Michelle was not convicted through the courts.
Rochelle hired a lawyer, and she did get that exonerated.
She had a public defender appointed.
Public
defender,
sorry.
But she was not convicted.
She, after a year, they were able to fight it, but it took a long, it was not an easy process.
She didn't have a diversion program?
No, something? She did not. They were, because of the district attorney decided not to prosecute after, it was about a year that they fought.
And then I guess the other question is really for the union itself. It sounds to me that bargaining isn't going too well on this position, on this issue.
Well, we can't bargain away criminal liability, unfortunately, Chair Brzezinski.
In the case of Sarah, where she's not convicted, it would seem to me that there should be the ability to have retro review of where someone's been terminated to come bring them back. So it just seems to me that y'all need to be looking at that as well. I mean, we're going to do our job up as to trying to take care of this, but it also seems like in this particular case, zero tolerance is not good, because it does in fact take good, honest individuals that working make a mistake, have an explanation that's good enough for law, but not a good enough for the employer.
And Chair Brzezinski, these issues are often taken to arbitration, but again, because it is a criminal, that even being charged with a criminal, we haven't fared as well as we would like. So,
yes. Senator Cruz.
The dash ones, take out that C, and confuses me a little bit, because I don't use those self-checkout things because I'm not smart enough to figure out how to do them. But, you know, monitoring those has got to be a pretty random thing, I would think. I mean, obviously there's somebody in charge, but, you know, like I go into the store I shop at where they have a couple of them, they're clear down there, and usually the person who's monitoring them is busy doing other things at the same time. So why is that being removed?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, that was actually removed. They, under the way that it had been written previously, they would not have been required, the self-checker clerks would not have been required to take the training class, and we had several stakeholders who wanted to maintain that everyone would have to take the training class under the current step, under 471.341.
We've had some discussions offline, and it just seems to me that we're putting people in a situation that just is unbearable as to that scenario. And it may be that the state needs to look at, since we protect and control the sale of alcohol in this state, that they will not be able to have those type of purchases going through a self-checkout line.
Okay.
And we're not going to be able to do it through this process today or this cycle, because we don't have enough time to do it. Okay. But I think there's a lot of interest in both caucuses and the Senate side to be looking at this, because it is from the way it's described to me, I'm just like Senator Cruz, I don't use those things. I don't go to a lot of stores that have them. But to me, when I have been in there, I've seen one individual looking at three or four lines. Yeah. And, it just seems like if they're going to take a zero tolerance, then they need to basically make sure they go through an actual line with an actual check.
And okay. Chair Brzezinski, actually, we had introduced that legislation in the 2013 session, and we were not able to gain the support in the House to move that bill. But this idea
started on the Senate side.
Yeah. Okay.
Next year. Okay.
This idea was brought forward by a number of legislators who asked, "What was the problem that we were trying to help correct?" And so that they suggested this legislation.
All righty. Any other questions or comments? And I think you've on the record about this to the dash ones as to this was being removed to ensure that everyone's going through the training.
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
Fine.
All right. Thank you very much. Mary, you're signed up. Did you want to still give testimony? While she's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1546? Come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We represent the OLCC employees who actually perform the sting operations. We certainly think that there should be some provision in law that provides for some leniency for folks who sell liquor inadvertently to an underage drinker. Do not misunderstand. Our union has a zero tolerance for underage drinking. And, I think that we need to make sure that the clerks are properly trained and have access to good ongoing training so that they don't do this inadvertently at all. I was not aware until 5 minutes ago that the self-check language have been taken out. That is one of the things that we are strongly in favor of. We testified in favor of it last session. We'll continue to support the elimination of taking controlled substances through self-check lines. I agree with you, Senator Cruz. I have as well stood there and watched one person try to watch six checkout lines while, you know, kids are kids are very innovative about how to gain access to alcohol. You know, we have proposals now where the grocers want to sell more distilled spirits. You know, this is going to increase the incentive for underage drinkers to access controlled substances in any way they can. And so, you know, we are prepared to work with UFCW on their bill. We're willing to help move the bill forward however we can. This is very important, but it's also important to know that when, you know, sting operations are done very cautiously and with forethought and planning, and, you know, we take that job very seriously, and we will continue to do them. You know, it is a partnership between the industries and the folks who enforce the laws. And so, you know, we need to make sure that people are getting the training they need, that there are adequate resources in place to protect the employees from sort of accidental mistakes. And, you know, doing sort of a termination, that's like a death sentence in employment. You know, once you've been terminated for selling alcohol to a kid, it's going to be really hard to ever get a job in that industry again. And so, you know, we just need to figure out a better way to do this. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasurer of UFCW Local 555. This has been an issue that I've been bedeviled with since about 1995. I had a 54-year-old man in 1995 working at Albertsons, 23 years with the company, impeccable record. Impeccable work record. But he sold to a cadet with the Salem Police Department in a sting, and it led to his termination because of the policy. And the policy is not such that it can be negotiated in a collective bargaining environment, because the industry has, the grocery industry, the representative mentioned two companies, but in fact there's a grocery industry standard that they comply to the strict liability of the public policy, the public purpose policy, and that it was criminal violations. Because of that criminal violations, they will not negotiated to the ability of not terminating on a first offense. And in fact, what brought us to this issue in 2007 additionally is that the National Hard Liquor Industry came with a bill introduced into the Oregon House to double the penalties on the clerks. We want to sell more hard liquor, but we want to look tough on this, so we're going to go penalize the grocery clerk. And it's just unreasonable and unfair. So this is really about taking a public policy and adopting it so that it also is conducive to a workforce policy. It really is important to recognize we're losing our friends and our neighbors on a policy that, if this changes, there may be the opportunity in a future arbitration termination case that they may not terminate and set a different standard like Colorado does. But it's not such that we can get at the bargaining table. And we would appreciate your consideration of this bill very, very much. I mean, you've heard from Sarah's testimony, and there's lots of Sarahs, and they're all throughout Oregon. And that police sting with Warren Carpenter in 1995, it's an irony. The police lieutenant in charge of the police cadets was my brother-in-law, which made it that much more onerous, but he was livid. He said the police want people who have been stung, they're better at inoculating, checking ID going forward. But the grocery industry, or the standard of the industry, is it's a disposable commodity, just terminate the employee, we look tough. It has to have something that recognizes the Oregon workforce. I appreciate your consideration of the bill.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right, so I asked our council to actually work on an amendment for the House side that maybe we can, in fact, put in the portion about not allowing for alcohol to be sold within self-checkout lines and still ensure that there's the education. We may not need to wait till 2015, but at the same time, we're not going to let that hold it up from not moving forward. So that's something that we'll be working on. And then I'll just say for Mary Botkins, for your unit that you represent that are doing the enforcement part, I would hope that they would actually look at a little bit more discretion in how they apply the law. And I can see where they may cite someone in the beginning, but where you have the situation where someone actually gets a medical doctor to say something was wrong and they have corrected that, it seems to me that they should have the ability to unsite them and not let it go through the criminal process. So thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay.
I made my statement.
Okay, and I appreciate that. As we work this bill, I think we need to be sure that our folks have that authority to change, because I think in the past there's been a question about whether or not we had the authority to move it back.
They're law officers, and they have the discretion to whether to cite or not to cite, and they could actually take it under consideration. And I've seen where officers in situations have backed it out, or they've contacted the district attorney's offices if it's a crime and say, we think this should not go forward. And
I certainly will have that discussion with
writing the ticket and saying, we're done with it, go tell the judge. Any other comments? Thank you. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1546. And our last one that we have is 1550.
I'm going to do a work session.
Oh, yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Let's go ahead and work session.
We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1546, and it looks like we do want to do the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1546.
All right, Senator Close moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 1546. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1546 as amended by the dash ones with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close now moves Senate Bill 1546 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Thank you. I just want to say I really appreciate this legislation, and also if we can get that amendment on the House side, I think that would be great. It's a shame that we weren't able to deal with this last session.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just for the record, as this bill is going to the House with that proposed amendment attached, I think it should be also noted the support of this committee for that amendment.
I agree. Yep. Okay. And I will talk. I'm assuming this is probably on its way to judiciary.
Yeah.
And so I'll talk to Chair Barker as well. All right. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion that's before us? So ordered. Senator Shields will be the carrier on that bill. And we'll go ahead and now close the work session on Senate Bill 1546. And our last bill that we have is Senate Bill 1550. What we do need to do is see if we can contact Mr. Spinney, who is the attorney representing the victim in this matter, that brought to our attention the need to look at modifying the invasion of privacy statute. And so at this point, we're going to take a recess while we try to get him on the phone. All right, we're going to go come out of recess, go back to order. We are now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1550. Bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1550 comes to you from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. What it would do, it adds to the crime of invasion of personal privacy circumstances, but where the purposes of arousing or gratifying sexual desire of another person, a person knowingly views another person or makes records or photographs, motion pictures, videotape, or other visual recording of another person without the other person's knowledge or consent in a place where that other person has an expectancy of personal privacy.
All right. So what I want to do is just put on the record that Ed Spinney is the attorney who represents Ms. Stutzman. If committee members remember, we had Ms. Stutzman before us and describing an adventure, event, I should say, that occurred in Springfield, Oregon, involving her and her daughter, specifically her daughter being filmed by a neighbor. We, at that point, were not able to move forward on anything because we needed to basically take a opportunity to get information from different interest groups and individuals. We had two professors who were looking at the constitutional issues, and they reported back to us, and that is what was the formation of what we have before us now, 1550. So, Ed, what I need you to do, if you would be so kind, give us your name for the record, and then if you can tell us where you and your client are as to my understanding not wanting the bill to move forward at this time and instead would like to see more work done on it during the interim.
My name is Evan Spinney. I'm an attorney in Springfield, Oregon. And I have reviewed the proposed amendments in the existing statute and have found out that there's an issue that has received a lot of national attention with legislation trying to catch up to the technological advancements and being able to spy on other people, basically. And I think my client agrees that this matter needs considerably more attention, review of what people are doing in other areas of the country to fill in the gaps and to maybe take a broader view of what needs to be done. The proposal, I think, is good, but it doesn't come close to really addressing a lot of issues that exist in this area. I spoke to Ms. Stutzman as recently as last night, and she agrees that this matter is something that she wants to see done comprehensively rather than just a stopgap measure to fill in the particular issues that she had to deal with recently.
All right, thank you. Questions for Mr. Spinney? And Ed, thank you very much. We appreciate your review of the measure that's before us, 1550, as well as the courtesy from Ms. Stutzman as to wanting to have a, I guess, a broader review of this and not moving forward at this time. So, is there any other comments? So, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and at this point ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 1550. Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1550. And Ed, I'm going to go ahead and disconnect unless you just want to listen to us conclude our work for today.
No, I'll disconnect, but I would say if this gets referred to a work session, I'd be happy to work with whoever does that. And I'd like to get input and see what I can do to help.
I appreciate your assistance, and what we more than likely will be doing is putting this on our work agenda for the interim for the judiciary, and I will be giving you a call or knocking on your door.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Bye.
All right, so we are now at the point of, let's see, we've now taken care of 1540. That has moved out. We've taken care of 1546. And that leaves us with 1550 that we just have heard. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 1550 until tomorrow. There is a possibility that there would be some additional amendments. There is something that has been being worked on during this first part of the interim dealing with Speedy Trial Act, and I expect that to be back and ready for us to go forward. This Bill 1550 does have a broad relating clause relating to crime. Purposely, so if there was some last-minute type of things that came forward,
it got stopped.
That it could, in fact, be used for that purpose. And so the Department of Justice, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, as well as I believe have been working hand in hand. I do know that ODAA has been involved to some level and maybe some other different groups. So at this point, we want to save that and leave that open for tomorrow. So at this point, we have, based on my review, we are carrying over for possible work sessions the following bills. Senate Bill 1531, Senate Bill 1550, Senate Bill 1551, Senate Bill 1556. And I believe that is everything we have currently on the Senate side.
Just minor little things.
Just a few minor little things to take care of, as Senator Cruz would say. And so with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. But I think what I want to do, we're currently scheduled for 8 o'clock. I do not believe we need to actually start at 8 because we have basically work sessions for possibly four bills. And we are posted or for 8, so we have to leave it posted for 8 is what I'm assuming, and we can have a delayed start or what?
Let me check into that.
Okay. Sure. So we're currently scheduled, and I'm going to roll this over to the current time that's posted, which is 8 a.m. There is a possibility that your offices will be informed that we will be starting a little bit later, but at this point we're not going to
show up.
Yeah, well, could, yeah. Well, I mean, just like they do on the floor, we, you know, the chair could come in and just say we're delayed until.
That's right.
So at this point, is there anything else, Mr. Taylor, no. Bill, we need to do?
The only thing I have is that 1550, if we do have an amendment, if you posted it 8, then we, without taking any special arrangements, we could secure it at 9.
Of course, he could post it at 7. Too.
Yeah, I think
he can post it at 7.
I think the amendment it's in the works right now.
Oh, so it might get done today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was finally sent in yesterday. We have been, I don't want to say hundreds of hours of input, I would say more likely thousands. Okay, and it was sent to Jessica Minifee yesterday. I just sent an email confirming that it would be Senate Bill 1550, that would be where it would go. So she has started the drafting process. So we will have it by tomorrow, I'm sure.
Yeah. So let me also put on the record and for members, there is a possibility, I've asked the president's office to allow us, if necessary, to meet in the afternoon sometime after our regular schedule. Since we are the first committee, 8 to 10, there is a possibility, as we've just noted, that we may need to come back later in the day to just finish up the work that needs to be done. So please be alert that we may be having a continuation recess from the morning session and picking it up sometime in the afternoon, hopefully not in the early evening. But it may have to be at 5:30. They're looking at 1 o'clock as a possible time because of they think the schedules may accommodate all of the members' other obligations.
On Thursday.
Education.
You have education. Then it probably would be early evening after, I know.
We have nothing better to do anyway.
Senator Roblin's committee will go till 5.
I'll just check that and see if we can get it down to.
But anyway, I would think it would be somewhere between after the 5 o'clock hour.
I think so too.
I mean, if we see the substance of it, you know, and then we're just waiting for the actual paperwork, it would take us 5 minutes to do it.
Yeah, we'll learn if council has this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Judiciary Committee meets at 1 o'clock.
Oh.
They have two or three times the number of bills that we have here. It may be difficult for staff to be here at 1 o'clock.
Well, it sounds like it's not going to happen.
We're not going to work either.
So, and I mean, Arnie and I both have 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock, so and you do too.
Yeah,
so,
I've got 3
now. But like I'm saying, Floyd, if we have, even if it's not in the final version of it, if we know what it is and we can go tomorrow morning, it'd be a 5-minute committee hearing.
Right.
So.
Okay, so again, we're going to conclude carrying over Senate Bill 1550, 1551, 1531, and 1556. Till tomorrow's agenda, which is scheduled for 8 o'clock, and that's where we'll be. Any other comments, Thank you. We're adjourned for the day. Thank you. We're adjourned for the day.